Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, it's the one and only Murder 123. This is Dr. John Stamey. I'm so glad to be with everybody. Just came off the road with Charleston Caricatures. We've been everywhere. We've been in Fayetteville, North Carolina. We were in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where we met an upcoming guest, and just it's been a wild and crazy weekend, but just so glad to be back here sitting in front of the control panel. And so tonight, let's see, Robin McRae is on special assignment. Devin Tate is hosting an event in Hollywood. We wish him well. I'm sure it's going to be wonderful. And so Dr. John is here with the one and only Tony Filosi, normally our co-host, but he is our guest tonight with a story for the ages. Tony, how are you doing?
I'm fine, John, and thanks for having me back to talk about Manzo Shepherd again.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, you know, Manzo was our number, has been our number one episode ever. In fact, it's the most listened to episode I've ever hosted. So with well over 300 people listening to it, and that's a lot. That's a lot of people listening to Manzo Shepherd. And you know, he was a short guy, and he really didn't have a lot of people that cared very much about him, and he wasn't treated very well, and he became a hardened criminal. You were a little bit, how can I say, you were a little bit kind to him when you sent me, if everybody will go to murder123.com, you will see a little bit of a background of some of the major players in tonight's episode, and you call Manzo Shepherd a petty criminal. He is not a petty criminal. He's a hardened criminal with a huge record, but he has a story that needs to be told. And Manzo, you know, if you want to come on tonight from beyond, let us know, and we'll always be glad to talk to you. So Tony, up there in Harlan, Kentucky, I got to say this: you always preface everything you say with "it's the biggest and whatever in Harlan County, Kentucky." Well, actually, some of the things you tell me are the most frightening and the biggest things that ever happened in all of Kentucky. Harlan apparently is a location where many horrible things have happened, especially the Manzo Shepherd murder incident. So fire away, buddy. Get us started on Manzo Shepherd, and why are we here tonight?
Well, John, we want to talk about Manzo Shepherd and the events leading up to the murder of Joe Christian in April of 1942. Manzo Shepherd, you know, as we've talked before, nobody cared a lot about Manzo. Well, we'll get into a little bit of the backstory on him.
Okay.
He was a petty criminal, much like, and I try to draw a parallel a lot of times between Manzo Shepherd and Clyde Barrow. Approximately within a year of being the same age when they died, both of them committed petty crimes. Both of them, I think Barrow's one of the things he went to prison for the first time was, including some other things, but Grand Theft Auto. Manzo Shepherd and his friend Sherman Klaus went to prison the first time for Grand Theft Auto. And whenever they came out of prison, they were changed men, you know,
and not in a good way.
They were not rehabilitated, and when Shepherd came out of prison, he wanted respect. He wasn't going to be slighted. He was going to be taken seriously one way or the other. But now Manzo wasn't near as intelligent as Clyde Barrow, and the reason I try to draw a parallel with Clyde is that I think that, you know, Clyde Barrow died in 1934. Manzo Shepherd would have been 14, 16 years old, somewhere in there. And the mode of news would have been either newspaper or the radio. So Manzo Shepherd.
I want to jump in real quickly because some people will not recognize the name Clyde Barrow. They will recognize mm-hmm. the name of the movie about Clyde called Bonnie and Clyde, starring Warren Beatty as Clyde Barrow. And Clyde was, he and Bonnie were absolute criminals of the highest order. They shot people up. They robbed banks. They were, in a sense, superstars of the criminal world, weren't they?
Yes. Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker wanted to be that. They set out to be, like I said, superstars of the criminal world. And at that time in the 30s, you know, you had Bonnie and Clyde, you had John Dillinger, you had the Barker Gang, you had Babyface Nelson, Machine Gun Kelly. You know, you had all these folks going, you know, that were making the news. And they were all trying to, in my mind, one-up each other because they enjoyed reading about their exploits in the papers. And the extradition laws back in those days were totally different. You know, when they crossed the state line, they were free and clear unless they come back into that.
Yeah, and you know, there's something else. I think the popularization of the criminal world came from that great movie Public Enemy Number One starring Jimmy Cagney. And
yes,
that popularized being a criminal, like, you know, and it was, again, you know, Jimmy Cagney is standing on top of the building saying, "Look, Mom, on top of the world." I mean, there's no one, it doesn't matter what age you are. I don't care if you're 15 years old, you know that scene. I think that is one of the best known scenes in all of movie history is Jimmy Cagney on top of and saying, "Look, Mom, on top of the world." And that's what popularized and romanticized the idea of being a criminal. It did.
Right.
It did.
And see, I think the Shepherd was influenced by all these things because he came from a really poor family. His dad wasn't very good to him. I don't believe his mother was just doing the best that she could. You know, he really didn't have a chance. And I don't think that Manzo from, you know, I was fortunate enough to meet Manzo's meet his niece, Kathy Schwabel. And I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. But super nice lady from Ohio. And shared lots of information with me, you know, about the Shepherd family and giving me some insights into Manzo Shepherd. And what was interesting is that she was very analytical. And, you know, her mother was Edith Boyd Shepherd, I believe, was her mother. And that was Manzo's sister. And they basically just said Manzo just was a mean sort. And that he, you know, that's just how that he was, and that's how that he wanted to be. It wasn't that he was misunderstood or he was, this is what the guy, especially when he got out of prison, you know, this is what he was going to be. And so was Sherman Klaus. Klaus and Shepherd, they had a long friendship. You know, they ended up going to prison together over the car theft, and they actually had consecutive ID numbers. I forget the first prefix, but the one was 515 and one was 516. And they were paroled on the same day. They went to prison the same day, and they were paroled, I believe, the same day, within a week of each other, but maybe the same day. And whenever they came out, they went to prison in 1937. And when they come out, in 38 or 39, late 38, 39, they did not learn their lesson. And they just set about doing just the criminal life, the thug life, I guess we would call it today. They didn't Miss Kathy had said, you know, that that her mom has talked about Sherman Klaus, and basically he was he was just a lazy person. He wasn't worth much. And you know, back in those days, if you didn't have a job, this is when Harlan County had 75,000 people in it, and you had some of the most productive coal mines in the world in Harlan County. And if you weren't working, you probably didn't want to work. It wasn't because you couldn't find work. So they had chosen this lifestyle that led them up to on the I believe it's the 23rd April 23rd to 25th of 1942 to engage Joe Christian, a taxi cab driver. Now Joe Christian, we have his death certificate, and more than likely he's a World War I vet, because in the block where it talks about is he a veteran, that's whited out, and I'm not sure if that's some sort of number, you know, that they put for his service or what, but there would be no reason to wipe that part out. But very possible a World War I vet. Mr. Christian was a lifelong resident of Harlan County. He was brought up rough, and you know, he lived through the Great Depression. Probably a World War I vet, had lived here all his life. You know, you got to think about Joe Christian. He was 48 whenever he was murdered in 1942. So you have to think that he saw the first automobile come into Harlan County. He saw the first railway come into Harlan County. He had lived through World War I, the Great Depression, and was used to a rough life. So I'm giving you a little bit of backstory on Joe Christian, that he's not going to be the type that's just going to hand over his money if three young guys, which we'll get to the third fella here just in a second. His name was Howard Hensley. He's a family friend and possibly a relative to either Klaus or Shepherd. They engaged Joe Christian the last week of April 1942 to take him to Virginia, to Appalachia, Virginia. And
now, why on earth would they engage a taxi driver to take them there?
Well, vehicles weren't real prevalent back in those days, and they were around, but Shepherd and them, you know, they didn't own a vehicle, and it wasn't uncommon for folks because Virginia, Southwest Virginia, was booming too, and so it wasn't uncommon for people from Harlan to go back and forth between. You know, from Kentucky to Virginia, because it being a border state and it being a booming economically. But the reason they engaged him was that Manzo Shepherd had got up that morning, according to court records, and said, "We're going to rob somebody," and that's the plan that they come up with on the fly, was engage a taxi cab driver, and they were going to rob taxi cab driver that day, going to rob somebody, and Joe Christian just happened to be that man. So they engage the taxi, and as they're going, they come through a place, a little town called Cumberland, and then Benham and Lynch, which have a lot of history in themselves, and they're going to cross the highest peak in the state of Kentucky, which is called Black Mountain. Now, the roads, the route itself is the same as it was then, just a few feet wider. But as they were coming, there's not a lot of places to pull off. There's miles and miles and miles of winding roads to cross that, I think it's 4,100 and some odd feet at the highest point of Black Mountain. So when they're getting close to the top, and Klaus and Hensley fake a fight. So they're cursing and slinging punches, and so Joe Christian pulls off to try to get him to you know, and he stops the taxi, gets out, going to break the fight up because they're tearing his taxi up. That's how he makes a living. So when he gets out, Shepard and Klaus and Hensley get out. Now, there's a couple of stories, you know, in the court records, you know, they all start pointing fingers at each other. But so you know, the court records are close, but now here's the way that from years of research that I'm pretty sure that everything happened. They get out, Shepard being the leader.
Okay.
He gets out. He said, you know, they want his money. Well, Joe Christian, having lived through the Great Depression, possibly World War I vet, and these three guys, they're trying to rob him. The oldest one's 26. You know, Shepard's 24. They're slightly built. You know, none of them are really big. So you know, you have this 48-year-old fella that's pretty rough, and he's not gonna capitulate and just hand over his hard-earned money. So he resists, and I think that he hits Shepard. He gets Shepard first, and kind of knocks him out of the way, and then Hensley and Klaus grab him and cut him. One says Hensley cut him first. The other one says Klaus cut him first. But whomever cut who first, Joe Christian, whichever one cut Joe Christian first, is a moot point because Joe Christian got cut. He got stabbed. Now, after they stabbed him, they beat him down. They held his arms, and Manzo Shepard walked up and cut his throat from ear to ear with a straight razor. And we have documented that with Joe Christian's death certificate. Cause of death is throat, you know, and the death certificate is throat cut. Now, whenever they cut Joe Christian's throat, you have blood goes everywhere. They take Joe Christian's, turn his pockets inside out, and they take, I think, $26 and something. They put Joe Christian in the car.
So they take nothing. They take basically nothing from him.
No, right.
$26.
They killed a man for about $5 and. And with Hensley getting the rest, so that basically the man lost his. To put it in perspective, Klaus and Shepard got $5.50 to kill a man that day. They killed a man for $5.50, and the thrill. So that tells you a whole lot about their mindset and how far they came from petty criminals to being able to do violence just in a minute. Because, you know, just think about it, John. I mean, if we, which neither one of us are going to rob anybody, but if we were going to rob someone and they resisted and said, would we automatically stab them and then cut their throat?
Well, certainly not for $5. Certainly not.
It will say at today's exchange rate that it will say it's worth 10 times. For $55, would we murder a man?
Never.
Never. I mean, you're not going to, nobody, I mean, nobody in their right mind is going to do that. Shepard. And Klaus, you know, their mindset was to go to use violence to get what they wanted. So this tells me, as fast as they went from zero to let's cut this guy and then slit his throat. Now you don't walk up and slice a guy's throat unless you're angry with him.
Or something. There's just no reason to do anything like that. And Jesus.
This is one of the reasons it was called one of the most heinous crimes in a place, most sensational trials and crimes in Harlan County's history up to that point. This is a place where that there were mind wars going on, and there were people, there were battles being fought, people being shot.
Tony, I want to stop you right here. I know what the mind wars are, but would you take a couple of minutes to explain what the mind wars were and the gravity of those? Because you've mentioned it several times, and a lot of people don't really know about the mind wars. Do you mind doing that?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. They started in the 20s. You know, Cole, I guess going back to the beginning, you had the timber industry here, and then you had the land speculators, and then they discovered there were massive coal reserves in here. And you had a lot of people from the Northeast coming in, you know, U.S. Steel, International Harvester coming in, U.S. Coal and Coke, which is U.S. Steel, came in. International Harvester founded Benham, which borders Lynch, Kentucky, with U.S. Coal and Coke. And those places were some of the first big mines in Harlan County. And they actually paid better. They owned the towns. They owned the rest of the county wasn't as fortunate. There were a few good companies to work for, but by and large, there was nobody. In Benham and Lynch ended up going union in the 30s or I think 30s or 40s. 30s, I think. But with very little violence up there in Lynch. But now in Benham, there were shootouts because you had the coal operators that basically wanted to work the men really long hours with low pay, no benefits. If somebody, we'll say that the husband went to work that day and he got killed in the mines, the family would get a maximum, this is at the good mines, a maximum of $1,500 for his death. We have my girlfriend, Jenny Fugit, she had done a lot of research on this for an episode that we did on the Benham area, we have documentation of this. So the man's life, basically, if you worked at a good place, was worth $1,500. Now the kicker to that is, well, now that he's dead, if somebody doesn't marry her almost immediately, because remember the company owns the town.
Yes,
they throw her out. If one of the, we'll say that she doesn't have a boy that's 14, 16 years old that goes to work in the mines to take his dad's place, and nobody marries her, they throw them out of town. Literally, pull in, load what stuff they have up, and take them out of town. That's how people were treated. That's at the good places. Now the worst places. Yeah, and the bad places were like you had a place called Commissary's Company Store, and
right.
Like I said, automobiles weren't that prevalent, so these guys got paid. A lot of them got paid in what's called scrip, and that was only redeemable. That was a form of currency. It was only redeemable.
Only redeemable at those commissaries. That's right.
That's correct. So they basically had a slave labor force. And the working conditions were awful. Now, also what they would do at the company store, we'll say that coal wasn't selling good and they were down to 2 or 3 days a week or whatever the situation was. Whenever a man drew his pay stub, he would have a lead pencil, and the old timers, you may remember this, your grandpa or somebody, they always would call, instead of calling it a pencil, they would call it a lead pencil. A lead pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. That was real common for shopkeepers and people like that to use back in the day. And they would draw a line, a squiggly line through the man's pay stub, which they called a black snake. So the first time I heard that term was my grandfather was talking about something about the coal camps, and he said, "Well, you couldn't do any good there because you'd always end up drawing a black snake." And I had no, I'm thinking, what in the world? So I asked him, and he explains to me, he was there, he had, seen this. My grandfather lived back in those days. So I'm getting, I have a lot of firsthand information, and we've interviewed a lot of people, but the conditions were horrible. And in some of the worst mines, if the fella got, if he got killed in the mines, they didn't give him, there wasn't any compensation for the family. And within, I think it was 2 weeks or so, 2 weeks to 30 days. It was no more than 30 days. If somebody hasn't married the widow, they physically came in, removed them from the home, loaded their stuff up, took them to the main highway, and set them on the side of the road. So those were the kind of conditions that no health care. The only health care provided was by the company doctors, which some of it was free and some of it was charged against your check. And each light they had in the homes, they would have they call them drops. But it would just be an electrical cord with it's just a light bulb receptacle, and they charged you so much per month for each light bulb you had in your home, extra on your rent. So these guys, okay, and so that's the backstory of the kind of conditions that these men were in. So in comes the UMWA and starts organizing. The men are wanting better working conditions for their families. They want for their children to have a chance. They want
Tony, who wouldn't want to join the United Mine Workers Union with conditions like that? Who wouldn't want to join
right.
it?
Right. So what you had was you had the company which owned the towns, literally owned the towns. Now, it's not like it is nowadays. Lynch, Kentucky, and Benham, Kentucky, are two that I'm most familiar with. The coal companies owned the whole town until the early 60s, until the early 1960s. Owned everything.
Now what happened in the early 60s that changed everything? I mean, how did the ownership move from the coal companies to other people?
I think that the laws were getting more labor friendly. Besides the UMWA, and it I think they looked at it as more of a business proposition instead of them having to keep up everything. They said, well, if I sell this house to this miner, and the mindset had changed. You know, you couldn't control the people like you could. You couldn't bring in gun thugs, and you couldn't have the company police, and you couldn't have this, you know, to have a captive, basically indentured, a whole town of indentured servants. Yeah, you were paying them, but you abided by every regulation that the company set down. You kept your grass cut. You kept and there were some of these places that were model towns. But if you peel the onion, the layers off the onion a little bit deeper, what price were you paying? Because they painted your house. You had a choice of three colors. They did everything for you. At the Benham and Lynch, at the bigger coal mines. Now the other coal camps, not so much. But I think it became more of an economic thing than them just being nice. I think it was cheaper for them just to sell the homes to the men, and the coal was starting to go down at the time. In the early 60s, 57 is whenever a lot of mines started shutting down.
If you think about it, really, they weren't doing anyone a favor. They were making money from selling all the assets that they had, including those homes.
Yes.
So it's like down here in Myrtle Beach, when you take an old hotel and then you sell that room as a condo, and you know, back in the day, you were getting $30,000-$35,000 for just some old hotel room. You weren't doing anyone a favor. You were giving them a week. You know, you were selling them a timeshare. So I mean, you know, if you really think about it, these coal mining companies, they weren't doing anyone a favor by selling them those dumpy houses. They were making a killing.
Yes, they were selling them to them because it was, you know, and they sold them to them at fairly decent prices. But the thing was, is they didn't have to keep them up anymore.
Right.
Now the men had to keep them up. So they made, you know, however much money, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 a home, and then the man had to start doing all the maintenance on it. So and the companies probably still own the stores, but you know, it was just a racket. It was but the UMW came in.
It was a racket. Yep, absolutely.
A racket. But so UMWA came in, and hence started the fight. The coal operators did not want to give up that control of the captive workforce. The men wanted a better life. So it was like the North and South. You were split, you know, down the middle a lot of times, with those that wanted to be with the UMWA and those that did not. Fear of the company kept a lot of them from signing up. If they knew that you were talking to the UMWA or you were trying to organize for the UMWA, there was a lot of murders. I mean, you were ambushed, you were beaten, you were taken. If you lived in the company housing, you were automatically thrown out of town. So you know, then you had these pitched gun battles. You had some in, or one in Benham. You had some in Everett. You had one in a place called Crummies Creek, where several people were killed in these battles. And those were just a few that I can name off the top of my head. There were many more. They were so bad that the governor had to send in on a regular basis the National Guard to keep order.
Wow.
And same thing happened in West Virginia, too. Same thing happened in West Virginia and parts of Virginia. But anyway, with all that violence, and they would, like I said, your warning was they would blow the porch off of the house. That was the warning with dynamite. And then the second time they blew the house up, or they would shoot the houses up. My other grandfather remembers seeing a union organizer. He was coming. The swinging bridges were prevalent back then, And he remembers when he was a young man, there was a union organizer coming across the swing bridge, and he saw him get shot and just fall down into the water below. So, like I said, I have some firsthand accounts of, you know, this isn't fairy tales, this isn't Hollywood, this is what happened here. So whenever they back to the Manzo Shepherd deal, you know, you had a place that was used to violence, you know, and what Manzo Shepherd, Sherman Klaus, and Howard Hensley did that day shocked people that were used to these types of things. So they had to be pretty heinous. So now we're getting back to where they're at on the top of the mountain. Manzo slices Joe Christian's throat. Okay? There's no reason to slice his throat if you already got him beat down and you can take his money. So he has humiliated, or, you know, Manzo feels like he's belittled him. So Manzo steps up, slices his throat, you get the arterial spray, it's all over the men. They put him in the car. They drive him about 200 yards on into Virginia, dump him out like a sack of potatoes over the mountain. He rolls down the mountain about 75 feet, where he's found about 10 days later. Now, during this interim period, Manzo Shepherd and company are pulled in by the sheriff.
Now, why was that?
They were the last ones seen with Joe Christian. They were the last ones seen. So, Clint Ball, I believe, Ball brings them in and can't hold them because he doesn't have a body. He doesn't have the evidence to hold them. So they leave the sheriff's office from the questioning, walk down the street, and they steal a car. Now, this is, you know, Manzo and them have plenty of moxie, so to speak, but they're short on brains. Now, after they steal this car, what do you think they do? Do you think they take off out west, change their names, and, you know, kind of blend in and live out the rest of their lives? No, they don't.
I'd be gone to Idaho.
I'd be out of there. What do? They go. Well, let me tell you what they did before they did that. I got ahead of myself a little bit. After they killed Joe Christian and threw him over the mountain, they got $26. You know, as we said before, Manzo got $550, Klaus got $550, and Hensley got the rest of it. They probably give Hensley the rest of it, thinking he's going to keep quiet. Because, you know, Manzo and Klaus have been through this before. And in the trial, he keeps talking about, well, I didn't do this, I was afraid they were going to kill me, but, you know, for whatever reason.
By the way, if you don't mind, real quickly, tell us about Hensley. Where in the heck did he come from?
Hensley lived in a little town called Mary Alice. It was a coal camp. He was from that. And I know you don't know where that's at, but he didn't really. He probably lived 10 miles from Klaus and Shepherd. So he was either a family friend or a cousin or something, and he kind of got pulled into this robbery and hanging out. I think he started hanging out with them and then kind of got sucked into the lifestyle, what they were doing. After they murdered Christian and dumped the body, they took the man's car, still bloody clothes, without a doubt, they've had to clean the money off a little bit because you got blood everywhere. Take the car, drive to the neighboring county to a roadhouse. Now, a roadhouse is a nice way of saying it's a place where you gamble and there's women of ill repute that ply their wares. So they go get liquored up and buy them some female companionship right after the murder. They drive straight from there to the roadhouse to blow off steam. Now, again, mm-hmm. How cold is that? I mean, what's, you know, and so, you know, again, this goes back to the reason people call this is one of the most heinous crimes up to that time and most sensational trials, because it was just the callousness of it. These guys weren't trying to, you know, like in the mind wars, you can kind of understand, you know, one side wants one thing, the other side wants another thing, and they're fighting it out. There's a logic to it, unfortunate logic, but, you know, you have the haves that want to keep the have-nots down, and they're clashing. You know, that's logical. You know, and when it goes on, you know, you say, well, in war, there's casualties, and you can kind of get your head wrapped around that. But just to callously cut a guy's throat from ear to ear, take his money, take his car, drive to the roadhouse, and party down with the dead man's cash is pretty damn cold.
You are correct, sir. You are 100% correct. That is old, but it's what happened. I mean, you know, these are the tales that we hear on Murder 123, and it's fact.
So they then they leave the roadhouse with the with Joe Christian's taxi. Manzo goes home and tells his mom. You know, they're a rough bunch, you know, and tells his mom what they've done. What do you think mom does?
Well, from what I already know, mom wants to take care of Manzo and she wants to protect him.
So she goes with them. Manzo and his buddies take the car up to a secluded spot. Mom follows them. Mom's in
now this is Joe Christian's taxi cab, right?
Yeah, this is Joe Christian's taxi cab. They take the plates off of it. They burn the car. They get in the car with mom, and off they go. They come back. So she helps them dispose of the car, dispose of the clothing, and gets them on out there. Get some fresh clothing and stuff and gets them on out of there. After that, they're picked up. Within a few days, were picked up for questioning. As they leave the sheriff's office, they go two, maybe three blocks. There's a car with keys in it. They steal the car. Instead of trying to make their getaway, they go pick up four females, some liquor, and they head to Virginia. Why in the world are they going to Virginia, you know, that's where they just dumped the body, you know, same state, but I mean, I don't know if they went to the same route toward Fredericksburg, Virginia, is where they got, because they got caught for speeding outside of Fredericksburg, Virginia. I think Klaus was driving. So they pull them out of the car, run the tags. Tags are stolen, or call Harlan County and say, hey, we got these guys here, blah, 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 blah. Here's the tag number. Are they wanted for anything? They said, yes, that's a stolen vehicle. These guys are wanted for murder. So also during this, whenever they were going through the car, they found one of the murder weapons, a hunting knife, under the seat. So, you know, these guys, they're either the most brazen, don't care, wannabe Bonnie and Clyde or Clyde Barrow wannabes ever, or they just don't care. I mean, who puts the murder weapon under the front seat, four women in the car, and it's a rolling party toward some town. Who knows why they were going to this town? So anyway, they extradite them back to Harlan County. The sheriff goes up. I think it's about a 13-hour drive in those days, if I'm not mistaken, from the newspaper articles. And they bring them back. Now, Manzo Shepherd and Sherman Klaus stand trial together, the first trial. Hensley gets a second trial because this is where all the finger pointing starts. You know, they're all big and bad until it comes time to go in front of the judge and jury. So, Klaus and Shepherd have their trial first. There's a mistrial. A preacher on the jury, there's 11-1, didn't believe in the death penalty. So, it was a hung jury. As soon as the preacher comes out of the jury box, the sheriff arrests him. They've sworn out a warrant for him. The sheriff arrests him and takes him upstairs to jail for obstruction of justice. So they were wanting to convict Shepherd and them bad. They were making the example of, say, look, we have the evidence, we have. And Miss Shepherd, Mally Shepherd, had been arrested at this time also as an accessory. So Shepherd, the second trial took place 2 days later.
So now I'm sorry. I want to make sure that we got it right. So they are arresting the preacher.
Yes.
Who refused to vote for the death penalty. For obstruction of justice.
Correct. Yes, I have it in the newspaper articles.
Tony, I hate to be a dumb guy from Myrtle Beach, but how can you do that? How can you do that? What charges? Obstruction of justice? What do you mean?
I'm telling you, in Harlan County, it was a different world.
In other words, you could just do whatever the hell you wanted to do.
Yes, and at this time, the coal companies and the sheriff's office and all them still held sway. So whenever that guy did not do that, and they knew Shepherd was guilty, Shepherd and Klaus Henson were guilty. So they were setting an example for the next jury that was picked. That was the message they were sending. So the second trial takes place 2 days later. The first trial was May 19th, 1942. The second trial was May 21st, 1942. Shepherd stands it. He has his own trial. During this trial, there's 300 people in the courtroom. It's packed. They're patting people down. There are no guns allowed in the courtroom. So they're patting the men folk down. Now, but they're not patting the females down, obviously. Now, that comes into play here just in a few minutes. So Shepherd is full of bravado. And one thing about Manzo, he was going to play it to the end. He didn't break down. He didn't whine. He didn't cry. I mean, he was, you know, the Harlan County Clyde Barrow at that point. I mean, he did not he didn't blink, so to speak. So he's sitting at the table. He's at the defense table, and there's 300 people there. The first trial ended in a mistrial. You have, in the audience, you have Joe Christian's sister and his nephew. His nephew is named Jack Heaton. Mrs. Heaton starts breaking down. She starts getting really emotional. You know, she's had to listen to all this stuff twice about how that her brother was robbed, how he was murdered, how he was thrown over the mountain like a sack of potatoes, how these guys did this. There's no remorse. There's no pity. And she's had to listen to this through two trials, 2 days apart. So she starts breaking down. She's getting real emotional. And Manzo turns, he hears her. She's standing fairly close to the defense table. Manzo hears it. No remorse, no pity. What do you think that he does? He turns around, looks over his shoulder, and laughs at her. Cold, callous, laughs at her. Turns back around. As he turns back around, the nephew, Jack Heaton, takes a couple of steps, and he pulls a pistol.
So he stands up, takes two or three steps, and pulls a pistol, and what happens?
Shoots him in the back of the skull. Shoots him in the back of the head. The bullet, he shoots him with a .32 revolver. It goes through the back, enters the back of his skull, goes to the front, doesn't exit, makes a knot, and Manzo, there's the account that I find the most, there's a couple accounts, you know, it's just, and there's very little difference in the description of both on how he died. He goes forward, and then his head comes back, and his mouth comes open, and he slumps into the partition between the defense table and the audience, the spectators. Now, how did Jack Heaton get the gun? They were patting people down. How did he get the gun in there?
I guess his mom had it in her pocketbook.
Well,
did I guess right?
It was allegedly snuck in by one of his young cousins, a 14-year-old female. Stuck it in and gave it to him through the proceedings. And that's how he ended up with the gun. So you got all this going on. You got, you know, females sneaking guns in to the men. You have the moms helping burn cars. I mean, back then women were tough back then. They were tough, buddy. And,
well, if you want to talk about tough, Tony, I got to interject something here. If you want to talk about tough, this coming weekend at the Somerville Comic Con, we're going to be doing the first time that we've done Murder 1-2-3 live on the road. We're going to be talking about Lavinia Fish. And those gals back then would take a bull whip. They would whip the boys. I mean, you talk about tough. Women have gotten so... I know I'm going to get in trouble here. Tony, forgive me here. Women are so nice today. Back in the day, they were just mean as everybody else. They would bull whip you. And I mean,
definitely Miss Shepherd, you know, and you have to put yourself in Miss Shepherd's position. You know, income, even though Manzo was a bad apple, you know, she had to care for him. And she.
You're talking about Mally Shepherd.
His mom.
Mally. You know she loved him. Exactly.
Yeah. Had to. And so, you know, she knows he's a bad sort. She knows he's already been in prison. She knows what he is. But that mother's love. You know, and I'm not condoning what she did. I'm just saying, you know, you can kind of understand. And they end up letting her free. You know, they right now they've got her in jail as an accessory. But they end up dropping charges against her. So, anyways, Jack Keaton takes two or three steps. Bang. Shoots Manzo in the back of the skull. Manzo slumps over into the partition. Shepherd, for all intent and purposes, is dead than a hammer right there. They take the gun away from Jack Heaton without a fight. He just hands it to the sheriff. Now, Judge Forrester orders the doors to be shut down. Shut the doors. Nobody comes in. Nobody goes out. Well, they take Heaton out. And he orders the jury, he orders Shepherd, take him to the hospital, which is about two or three blocks away, to make sure that he's dead. Which, you know, obviously being shot in the back of the skull, you're probably pretty well done. But they wanted to pronounce, they wanted closure. He wanted closure for that family. So he orders the jury to render a verdict. They deliberate 10 or 15 minutes. They come back.
Immediately. In other words, he says, go into the room, give me a verdict. Now.
Yes. Yes. That's right. So 10 or 15 minutes, they come back out. It only takes like 5 minutes to get him to the hospital. Hospital is only about three blocks away. And so they render the verdict. They come back out. Judge asks them, have they reached a verdict? They say, we have, Your Honor. And Judge Forrester says, what's the verdict? They say, we find the defendant, Manzo Shepherd, guilty of murder and recommend death by electrocution. And he accepts that. He has, it's either the sheriff or the bailiff to call over and say, well, how's Shepherd? They said, tell the judge he's not been dead 2 minutes. Because it was all made up before he ever left, before they ever got out of the, you know, out of the room with him. I mean, he was dead in the room. So, the judge, they said, Your Honor, Shepherd just died. You know, he signs off on it and convicts a dead man.
Wow.
Because he wanted that family to have closure. And it was just, and you know, in the judge's mind, the callousness of Shepherd and things, I think, motivated him to do that. Now,
I was getting ready to ask, what happened to Jack? What happened to Jack Heaton?
Well, here let's talk a little bit about Klaus and Hensley. Klaus and Hensley, and also the chair that Manzo Shepherd's sitting in. Manzo Shepherd's sitting in a predetermined chair at the defendant's table. At the defense table, and he gets killed in that chair. In October of 42, Klaus and Hensley's trials come up again.
Okay.
They both plead out, and I think they're sentenced the same day. They sit in that same chair. Each of them sits in that chair. and they're sentenced to life in prison, sitting in that same chair that Manzo Shepherd was shot in front of 300 people. Well, in February of 1943, the trial of Jack Eaton starts. It's standing room only again in that courtroom, because this is big news. You know, I mean, people have been talking about this for months. So they bring Heaton in, and prosecutor starts. It ends up, basically, he says, "Well, Mr. Heaton, what happened? He says, "You know, I killed him. Everything went black. I went crazy. When he looked at my mother and he laughed, I went crazy and I shot him. I did it."
Temporary insanity, right?
Yep. That was what they're trying to prove. Well, now, you got to figure that Jack Eaton killed Shepherd in front of 300 people. A little hard to, you know, he stood there through the whole trial. He's done this. He's trying to cop an insanity plea. But it's Harlan County. And
it's what it's going to be.
Yeah. He says, "Was that it?" He goes, "That's it. He laughed at my mother. She's been through all of this. I lost it. I killed him. I shot him. I did it." So,
and the verdict was,
well, the jury deliberates for 10 minutes. There was a female jury foreman. I think her name was Miss Frazier. The judge says, "Madam Foreman, have you reached a verdict?" And she says, "Yes, we have, Your Honor." He says, "And what is it?" She says, "We find the defendant, Jack Eaton, not guilty by reason of temporary insanity." The judge slaps the gavel down, says, "Case dismissed. You're free to go." Jack Eaton dies.
How awesome.
Jack Eaton dies of natural causes in Los Angeles, California in 1982. Mally Shepherd's released from
Shepherd.
Yep, Kentucky Justice, Harlan County Justice.
No, sir. And I'm going to go on the record on Murder 123, and I'm going to say that is justice. And Jack Eaton deserved to walk. I'm sorry, he did.
He walked. He left Harlan County shortly afterward for fear of retaliation. But Mally Shepherd was released. Now, the interesting part of that is, guess which chair Jack Eaton was sitting in? He was sitting in the chair he shot Manzo Shepherd in. Now, how's that for irony?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Tony. What you have done is you have painted an unbelievable picture. Actually, you painted two pictures. One is the murder of Manzo Shepherd, and the other is the trial of Jack Eaton. And it's like, what on earth went on? I mean, these are fantastic stories. And we're so happy to have you on Murder 123 to tell us. And this is stuff that nobody knows about. This is Harlan County, Kentucky. A lot of people don't even know what the Mine Wars were.
Absolutely.
And my friend, my co-host, because you're actually our co-host. You're our guest tonight, but you're our co-host normally. And this is amazing stuff. And
now,
oh my God,
there's a few twists and turns. Now that we've got through the main part of the play, so to speak, let's talk a little bit about how they may have been involved in a murder 6 months before that.
They being whom? Now, they being Manzo,
and
Sherman Clow.
Yes.
Howard, or just Manzo and Sherman.
Manzo and Sherman will be my guess. Now, this was an unsolved murder that happened in this courthouse. You have three levels. You have a fourth count the jail on the top. You have the basement. You have the first level where the clerk in the sheriff's office was. Then third level was the courtroom and a couple of offices. And then the fourth level was the jail. In the old courthouses, they usually had the jails on the very top, so they bring them out of the jail down a back set of steps and straight into the courtroom.
Well, they did. That was actually quite typical of most southern institutes of justice, because in Jackson County, North Carolina, that's how it worked. Because I've been there, and the old jail / courthouse has been turned into the library. But you go to the very top floor, and there's the jail.
Yes. They're a real interesting place to investigate also. I mean, there's a lot, I don't want to get off topic of the historical part, but now I will tell you this, and then we'll delve on into this other murder, that, I do a lot of paranormal investigations, and I have caught several EVPs from Manzo Shepherd in the courtroom where he was murdered at.
And that's interesting. And by the way, I want to give you a plug, because everyone, Tony Filosi is the host of The Cell Block at 10:30 p.m. in the middle of Murder 123. He's the host of The Cell Block. And he comes in with insight on murders, on ghosts, on whatever. Last week, it was unbelievable. You had some great conversation about just regular murder, because we had Rob Kellum, Papa Stro Maestro. In fact, I had dinner with Papa Stro last night. Just one of the nicest people God ever put on this planet, and I mean that. And we had a lot of fun, and he was talking about being with you on The Cell Block. So I'll tell you what, we cover a lot of great material. We cover a lot of great guests here on Murder 123. Anyway, I'm sorry, that's the plug. Join Tony Filosi every Monday night, 10:30 p.m. for The Cell Block on Murder 123. I'm turning this back over to you, Tony.
Okay. And I'm going to do a shameless plug for, Thomas Markham and I have a series called Crypto Files, which is part of the Crypto Crew. The Crypto Files is a series, and it's on Amazon Prime. We have several episodes out. One of them actually is about Manzo Shepherd. So if anybody's interested, they can go watch that on Amazon Prime, as well as some of our other films, which deal with a whole lot of history and unexplained. So check us out on Amazon Prime. You can search either Thomas Markham's name or my name, and the film's filmography will pop up. And if you could go over to the Crypto Crew, give us a like and a share, and we would really appreciate that. So that's my shameless plug.
Well, now, Tony, I tell you what, would you allow us to put a link to the Manzo Shepherd material on Amazon Prime from Murder 123?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We'll get you that information.
Well, thank you, because I tell you what, Manzo Shepherd is, in a lot of ways, our, how can I put it? He's our poster child. He's a good boy, and he went bad, and he's our poster child. So Manzo knows from the depths of wherever he is that his memory is being lauded and celebrated and applauded here at Murder 123. and through Tony Filosi and Dr. John Stamey, and of course Robin Hayes, McCray, and of course Devin Tate. We just know Manzo Shepherd needs to be remembered, correct?
Yes. Now, and that's what Manzo wants. And Manzo getting exactly what he wants. I know that sounds kind of strange, but where I've researched this for so many years and done a lot of paranormal investigations at the murder site, I can promise you one thing, that this is what he wants, and this is another tie to Clyde Barrow. Manzo Shepherd wanted to be remembered. He wanted to be infamous, and Manzo Shepherd is getting what he wants. And
Murder 123 is going to make sure that he gets what he wants, Tony.
Well, I promise you, John, this is hopefully you can get down to Harlan and we can investigate the courtroom, because when Manzo is of the mind, you'll get some of the craziest EVPs, which are electronic voice phenomena. It's unbelievable, because he loves attention and he likes to talk, and he will tell you what he did, and he's told us who killed him, several times, but on tape. I've caught him in 2016. He named his Jack Heaton as the shooter, and in 2019 he named Jack Heaton as the shooter. So what I try to do is play statistical probabilities. So the statistical probability of 3 years apart asking a specific question to Manzo Shepherd about who murdered you, and you get the same answer, are just unbelievable. It just can't happen. So Manzo is still in that courtroom, and he does like the attention. But now, let's talk a little bit about the murder that I think that they committed, and why I think they committed murder.
Okay.
And
tell us.
And if they weren't the trigger men, they were definitely involved in it, because there's just too much circumstantial evidence. Now, there was a fella, and we talked about this Bill Lewis last week. But Bill Lewis was a guard. He was actually a deputy sheriff, and he was what you would call an enforcer or a gun thug. Now, during the mine wars, I told you a little bit of backstory about how they would do the union organizers. Well, there was this gentleman in 1937 in a town called Verta, Kentucky, that was, his name was Lloyd Klaus. And he and his brother Jasper were talking to some of the miners that morning about the union. And they were looking for a particular fellow to talk to. His name was Dosher. Bill Lewis and a couple more deputies went to Verta to find Lloyd Klaus. Well,
okay.
How the article goes is they were waiting on them. They knew they were supposed to be through there that day. So they were in a saloon, and Klaus and his brother came in, and they didn't acknowledge the deputies. They were looking for this one fella, and they leave. Well, as soon as they get out into the street, out come the deputies with Bill Lewis in the lead. They call upon him. Bill Lewis calls on him and says, "Hey, stop. We want to search you guys." This is in 1937. What are they going to search him for? Liquor? Prohibition. So it's basically a shakedown. So as Klaus starts turning, the Klaus brothers start turning around. They face the deputies, they pull their pistols and they shoot Lloyd Klaus dead. he's the main union organizer that they're after. So they shoot him dead. They close in with his brother. He starts fighting them. They pistol whip him about to death. And when he wakes up, he's laying beside his dead brother's body. He gets up, takes his brother's body and his family back to the next county over, Bell County, for their safety. These people end up, Bill Lewis gets out of this and the deputies, it's real self-defense. But within 10 days, the Klauses and some other folks are in Washington, D.C., testifying before a judiciary committee about the violence, the mine violence in Harlan County. And they give some really, really good testimony. But it does, you know, there's nothing ever done to Bill Lewis or the deputies. So fast forward to now. Lloyd Klaus leaves behind 10 children. Two of those 10 children's names are Sherman and Mary. So Lloyd Klaus is Sherman Klaus's father. Mary Klaus is living with the Shepherds at the time, according to the 1940 census. Manzo Shepherd has a brother named Florin. So let's fast forward to 1941, November of 1941. You have Bill Lewis guarding ballot boxes. He's working the third shift. He comes in from lunch. About 1:20 or 1:40 a.m. He comes in, starts back to his post. An unidentified assailant comes from, this is on the second level of the courthouse, comes from the first level of the courthouse. The assailant comes from the basement up to where Bill Lewis is, shoots him 5 times. And escaped out a side door and is never found. Now, within 1 week.
Or they didn't want to find him.
They didn't want to find him. I think that it was a hit. But I think that people, maybe.
Hey, Tony. We've got a call in from area code 54574. Let's see who this is. Okay.
Okay. So
we have a call in from 574. Who's this?
My name's Scott. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I just tuned in. So you're just gonna have to forgive me. Who are you talking about, and what's the subject?
We're talking about Manzo Shepherd, the murderer from Harlan, Kentucky. And we're glad you joined us. What's your first name, sir?
Who did he kill? Scott. My name's Scott.
You're Scott, and he killed Joe Christian, a cab driver.
Who's Manzo? Sounds like a dog's name. Who's Manzo Shepherd?
Fill him in,
Tony.
When
did this happen?
Manzo Shepherd was a gentleman that lived in Harlan County,
Kentucky.
Harlan County, Kentucky. He murdered Joe Christian. Him and two of his cohorts murdered Joe Christian in April of 1942 on top of Black Mountain.
So who was black and who was white? Because there has to be a racial element to that.
Actually, there wasn't. They were all white.
white man killed a white man in 1942 and it wasn't in war?
No.
In Kentucky? All right. So one was a cab driver, you said, so far?
Yes, he was a cab driver.
Why are you talking about it in 2019?
Because it's history and that's what we like to do.
Oh,
and
okay.
And we've got EVPs, or, you know, electronic voice phenomenon, recorded of Manzo Shepard in the courtroom. Manzo's still alive.
How do you know it was him? How do you know it was him? But y'all are ghost hunting kind of people, right?
A little bit.
How do you know it was Manzo Shepard?
Absolutely. We've got some EVPs of Manzo. Is there anything else you'd like to know, sir?
Well, no. I just tuned in, and I was trying to understand what you were talking about. You told me a little bit about it. It's not what I expected at all. I didn't expect it. Was Manzo the shooter?
No. Manzo cut Joe Christian's throat with a straight razor.
Good Lord. Okay. So he was the murderer.
Yes, he was a murderer that got murdered.
So the conversations around what? Around the EVP stuff and what happened and the fact that this guy's spirit is still in the courtroom?
That's a sidebar. No. We're dealing mostly with historical facts this evening. But that was – we have called EVPs with Manzo Shepard. So, now let's get back to the second murder that I think Manzo or Klaus one was involved with. So you have Bill Lewis that had murdered Sherman Klaus's father 4 years previously. So Bill Lewis is assassinated in November of 1941. Within 10 days of Bill Lewis being killed, you have one of Manzo's brothers marry Sherman Klaus's sister, who's living in the household with the Shepherds. So you have to ask yourself, why so soon? Why did this happen? Was this kid six? The kid, Florence Shepherd is 16 and Mary Klaus is 19. That begs the question, did he have knowledge of what happened? Why did Mary Klaus marry one of the Shepherd boys within 10 days of the guy that murdered her dad being assassinated? So I think that somewhere in there that either Klaus or Klaus and Shepherd had something to do with that murder. Hello? Hello? Hello?